Welcome to the Science Podcast for June 1st, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, what quantum computers may someday achieve, restoring motion in paralyzed rats, and some astronomical mysteries.
Anybody who's looking for sort of a unified theory of how planets form has got to be pretty frustrated at this point.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Predicting what happens to particles as they collide in an accelerator like the Large Hadron Collider is an incredibly complex computing problem, too tough for even the most super of today's supercomputers. Instead, scientists are looking to tomorrow's quantum computers to solve quantum field theory equations. I spoke to Stephen Jordan about working on quantum problems with quantum computers from his office in Rockville, Maryland.
The question that we were addressing is, if we had a quantum computer, would we be able to use it to simulate quantum field theories, or in other words, particle scattering processes, such as what people see in particle accelerators, for example, the LHC. And this seems to be something hard on classical computers. There are regimes where classical computers basically just can't do it. And we found that at least for a specific quantum field theory that we considered, quantum computers can do it. This work, it was done in collaboration with Keith Lee at the University of Pittsburgh and John Preskill at Caltech.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about quantum computers. How are they different than, you know, my laptop at home?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that people use to think about quantum mechanics is the idea that particles can also behave as waves. And it's also true that, in principle, bits can behave like waves. So just as a classical particle, it's just in one place at a time, but a wave propagates out through a space of possibilities. Quantum bits can propagate through an exponentially large space of possibilities. And if you engineer things just right, you can make it so that these waves at the end all concentrate in one spot, which corresponds to the answer to your computational problem.
So how is that beneficial for someone who's doing a complicated computation?
Well, for some computations, it's actually not beneficial, which is kind of interesting. For some problems, quantum computers are spectacularly more efficient than classical computers. Mm-hmm. The famous example of this is factoring large integers. For other problems, they seem to provide no advantage. So we're trying to map out which problems are helped by quantum computation.
And so where are we with quantum computers right now? Are there any in existence, simple ones?
Well, there's small demonstrations in laboratories involving up to around 10 qubits or a few more, but it's still very preliminary. People have worked very hard. They're trying a number of different approaches, and at this point it's unclear which, if any, of these approaches is going to really become practical.
Hmm. Well, going back to your study, you looked at whether a quantum computer could solve a quantum problem. You said a quantum field theory problem. Can you describe what kind of problem that is?
Yeah, so you start out with some particles with a certain momentum. So you say, oh, maybe we have two particles that are coming straight at each other with 99% of the speed of light. And then when they collide, typically they produce a shower of outgoing particles, and what we want to predict is how many outgoing particles there's going to be, what kind they're going to be, how fast they'll be moving, and all those kinds of things. And the reason we want to predict that is because we can then directly compare it with experiment, such as what people do in particle accelerators.
And so when you wrote your algorithm and you simulated some of these scenarios, were you able to match what we see in colliders?
Well, so the quantum field theory we've looked at so far is kind of a simplified example. It only has one kind of particle. But we believe that this example contains most of the essential features that we would need to simulate more realistic scenarios with many different kinds of particles, electrons and photons and quarks and gluons and so on. So that's really the next step of our research, to try to extend our algorithm to simulate all the particles that we see in nature.
So what's the timeline for this? I mean, you're preparing computer programs to run on computers that aren't quite ready for the mainstream yet. When do you think that these kinds of things will be implemented?
Well, it's not completely clear. So as I've said, the quantum computers that are being tinkered with in labs currently are involving maybe a dozen qubits or so. It appears that to run our algorithm, one would need at least a few thousand qubits.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'll be some years before anyone can really test out our algorithm on real hardware. The interesting thing is that the details of the hardware, in some sense, don't matter.
Hmm.
That we can analyze the performance of our algorithm just using the general features of quantum computation. This is kind of a deep fact about computation, is that you can abstract away the details and the general scaling of algorithms will be independent of, for example, whether someone uses superconducting circuits or ions or silicon chips or anything like that.
It seems like this is pretty abstract in a lot of ways. You don't have the computer, you don't have the particles, and you don't have the details of what you're going to be studying yet.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, one of the motivations is that we would like to know what is fundamentally the computational power of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So even if we don't have a quantum computer as hardware to play with, we can already address this question on a theoretical level. So if we can show that quantum computers can efficiently simulate all the particles in nature, then that would prove that no process in particle physics is computationally more powerful than a quote-unquote standard quantum computer.
Huh. So what other directions can you take this kind of research in?
So one of the things we'd like to do is extend to more complete quantum field theory that would cover a wider variety of particles.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we treat bosons. We're working on fermions next, and those are the two major categories. Besides the practical applications, maybe thinking about the relationship between quantum computation and particle physics could help us understand quantum computation better and understand particle physics better. In the past, people have studied how to simulate something called topological quantum field theories with quantum computers. And it's not even clear that topological quantum field theories correspond to any experiment that's been done so far. But just by thinking about these as a conceptual tool has helped people discover new quantum algorithms for math problems, such as from knot theory, that are of interest independent of whether topological quantum field theories have any connection to physics. On the other side of it, there's an old quotation from Kenneth Wilson that I like to repeat, where he said something to the effect of, back in the 60s, he was thinking about how one could simulate particle physics using classical computers. And at the time, classical computers were very weak and clearly much too weak to actually do the simulations that he was thinking about. But just by using computers as a conceptual tool, he was led to deep insights about the nature of quantum field theory. So I think that's very analogous to our situation today with quantum computers.
Wow. Well, Stephen Jordan, thanks so much for talking with me.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Stephen Jordan and colleagues wrote a report on algorithms for quantum computing in this week's Science.
Despite decades of research, very little can be done to restore voluntary motion after paralyzing spinal cord injuries. But this week, a research team in Switzerland reports success in an attempt to restore locomotion in paraplegic rats. Their methodology, a so-called electrochemical neuroprosthesis, consists of electrical stimulation of the spine in concert with a chemical supplement and a robotic harness. The key, says senior author Grégoire Courtine, was the voluntary movement afforded by the harness, which allowed the brain to rewire and regain communication with spinal circuits. Courtine spoke with me about the study and began by explaining how this electrochemical neuroprosthesis works.
So the idea is to reestablish locomotion of the paralyzed hind limbs. So to help you to understand, I can use maybe a metaphor. You need to imagine that the locomotor apparatus is a car. and the engine is the spinal cord, but the transmission is interrupted. This means that the engine is turned off and the car does not move. So what does it take to regain control over the vehicle? Well, first, you need to provide the fuel. Second, you need to press the accelerator pedal. And third, you need a wheel to steer the car, basically. And the aim of this neuroprosthesis is to replace these missing elements. So we provide the fuel with a tailored cocktail of monoamine agonists, these are the chemicals, and we mimic the accelerator by applying electrical stimulations over the dorsal aspect of the spinal cord. And this is what defines this electrochemical neuroprosthesis. And basically what we observe is that as early as 1 week after this paralyzing lesion of the spinal cord, with the electrochemical stimulation, the rat show coordinated locomotion on the treadmill. And of course, in this case, the locomotion is completely involuntary. It is entirely controlled by the sensory information that are elicited by the moving treadmill belt.
And how do you define voluntary and involuntary motion?
Yeah, this is a complex idea. So voluntary locomotions means a goal-directed locomotion, meaning initiated by the brain. The animal on its own will direct his body towards a goal. That's how I would define locomotion in this case. And I would oppose this to automated locomotion, for example, on a treadmill, when the locomotion can be entirely controlled by the spinal cord without any brain contribution.
And what is the role of the robotic postural interface?
So, as I said, you also need the steering system. So here, our idea to replace the missing postural control was to design this very large, massive robotic structure that basically provides support against the direction of gravity and in the mediolateral direction, but does not facilitate locomotion in the forward direction. So you need to imagine the rats, you know, bipedally, actually, they're in a little jacket. And this massive robotic structure provides like a safe environment. This means that the rat basically can try to communicate with the spinal cord, which is in electrochemically enabled state, in order to regain voluntary control of locomotion.
So as you said, after about a week on this program, the rats were able to involuntarily walk on a treadmill. What did the rest of their rehabilitation program, this recovery regimen, consist of? And what was the sequence of events moving on after that first week?
So as you mentioned, Kerry, we position the rats, we train them on a treadmill at the beginning in order to optimize the functionality of the circuit below the injury. But every day, we also position the rats overground in the robotic interface, and we encourage them to walk voluntarily toward the target, like a reward that is located in front of them. And they are not capable of walking voluntarily for at least 2-3 weeks. They completely fail. But then, after 2-3 weeks training, they really regain the first effortful steps overground. And for the first time, they perform a movement that is voluntary. And next, we train the animal more and more overground, and we reduce the duration of the training on the treadmill in order to really encourage, force somehow the brain to enhance the communication, you know, with the circuit below the injury. And what we observe is that over time, the otherwise paralyzed rat not only regain the capacity to sprint over ground, but they can even like climb staircase and pass obstacles. This means that animals with paralyzing lesion of the spinal cord regain not only a voluntary control of locomotion, but also an adaptive control of the paralyzed hind limbs.
So if you were to release these rats back into a group of rats that had not been paralyzed, would you be able to tell them apart from their counterparts?
So if we perform like really detailed analysis of the kinematic of locomotion, we can actually hardly distinguish the locomotion of this trained rat with respect to intact animals. It was really a very extensive recovery. Although, of course, you observe like a range of recovery, but the best steps are almost impossible to distinguish, you know, from Interkrat was really surprising.
That's amazing. Could they have achieved this through only their treadmill training?
So this was really surprising also, and I think a very important finding of our study, that if we train the animal only on the treadmill in the presence of the electrochemical stimulations, the animal regain full weight-bearing locomotion on the treadmill. But because there is absolutely no brain contribution during this involuntary training on the treadmill, the animal failed to show any voluntary step of the ground. This means that with this automated training on the treadmill, we promoted the plasticity of the circuits that are trained, the circuit below the injury, but no plasticity of the connection between the brain and the spinal cord, because the brain was not engaged in the training procedure.
So what's happening in the brain on a neural level during all of this?
Yeah, so, I mean, what we observe is that over time, the brain forms new connections. So we observe that the motor cortex establish relay circuits in the brainstem as well as in the spinal cord, and that these new relays, basically they bypass the injury and they reestablish a cortical control of the locomotor circuits which are below the injury. And this also was very surprising because, you know, the motor cortex is not necessarily involved in controlling locomotion in rats. But here, this extensive plasticity of the connection really suggested that the motor cortex orchestrated the recovery, that basically the brain became the maestro, you know, of the regained locomotion.
So a year ago, there was a study published in The Lancet in which a man was paralyzed in a car accident and through a similar sort of rehabilitation was able to regain some control of his lower limbs. And so I'm sure that the question on many people's minds is your treatment translatable into humans? And so how does your research and this research from a year ago sort of work towards that goal?
So the study you mentioned really was a pioneer study in the sense that for the very first time, an individual with a chronic paraplegia regained voluntary movement. And the principles were very similar in the sense that this young man was trained to stand in the presence of electrical stimulation of the spinal cord. So in a way, the proof of principle that motor training under enabled state can promote plasticity and recovery in human has been shown.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly the true therapeutic impact of this type of intervention in human is really difficult to predict. What we can say is that the extent of the plasticity and the recovery that we have observed in the rats is extremely surprising. And clearly we have also observed this proof of principle in human. And clearly we cannot imagine that we will cure spinal cord injury with this kind of intervention. But I truly believe that it's open, promising perspective to really boost the functional recovery in human with spinal cord injury, in particular when the lesion will spare some fibers, and if we start the training procedure in the acute state of the injury.
Well, it's an incredible study and something to look forward to, absolutely. So, Grégoire Courtine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Grégoire Courtine and colleagues describe restoring locomotion in paralyzed rats in this week's issue.
What is dark energy? Why are the planets in our solar system so different from one another? The truly deep mysteries of outer space will take decades or more to solve. But in a special section this week, a team of news writers tracked down the very latest on a variety of unfolding astronomical stories. I spoke with Deputy News Editor Robert Kuntz about a few of them, starting with our very own mysterious sun.
You know, it's interesting. Nobody really knows how the sun works in any kind of detail. It's just so complicated inside, the whole mechanism. And the thing about the corona is that it's much hotter than you'd expect it to be, just given the heat of what's underneath. We know that there's enough total heat from the nuclear fusion processes in the core of the sun, but we don't know how it gets out to this outer layer called the corona. So that's what scientists are trying to figure out, exactly how this heat transmission mechanism works.
And so what are some of the potential explanations behind the heat of the corona?
Well, there are a couple of different possibilities. One is magnetic waves through these complicated electromagnetic pulses called Alfvén waves, oscillations of the sun's magnetic fields. Mm-hmm. And then another possibility is nanoflares that might actually shoot out bits of gas when the magnetic field lines of the sun snap and then reconnect. So it all has to do with interactions between the magnetic field and the actual charged gases that make up the sun. It's just trying to figure out what are the mechanisms behind it all.
All right. Well, let's talk about another mystery of our own solar system. Why are the planets so weird?
Okay. Now, this is interesting. You know, more than 500 planets have been discovered around other stars at this point, and some of them are pretty strange. They're really close in. They're really big. In fact, there's a reason for that. The reason is that the really strange ones outside the solar system are the ones that are easiest to spot. You want things that are really huge planets that are close in where they can have a big influence on their stars. That makes them easy for us to detect. But it turns out that right back here in our own solar system, there are still plenty of things that astronomers don't understand. You think that our own neighborhood might be kind of normal. Well, it's not. There are a lot of things about the planets that are just pretty bewildering. For example, you know, we have Earth and we have Venus. Those are thought of as being twin planets because they're about the same size, but they're very different. Earth has plate tectonics, these, you know, the crust that rides around and causes continents and mountain ranges and all the large-scale geology that we see. Venus seems not to have that.
Hmm.
And then Venus has got this amazingly hot, acid atmosphere caused by a runaway greenhouse effect that we don't have here on Earth. That's probably because it's closer to the sun. A lot has to do with, you know, location, location, location. But there are just a lot of mysteries why two similar planets went in such different directions. There are some other things, too, with the larger planets in the solar system farther out, Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. It's sort of hard to explain how some of them got so big, because in the early solar system, most of the material for planet formation would have been concentrated in close to the sun. Those planets are way out there where there wouldn't have been much to build planets from. How did they get so big? It turns out that just in the past couple of decades, astronomers have been playing with the idea that maybe they didn't start out there. Maybe they started out further in and migrated outward. The idea that planets can actually change their position in the solar system in such a radical way is pretty new, and it answers a lot of questions. You just have to accept the fact that some pretty strange things were going on in the solar system earlier in its history. So anybody who's looking for sort of a unified theory of how planets form has got to be pretty frustrated at this point, because it's just...
No help from our near neighbors.
No, it just doesn't add up in a simple way.
Well, let's talk about some more universe-wide mysteries. How about the case of the missing matter, baryons?
Now, this is one that no one's heard about. Everyone's heard of dark energy. Everyone's heard of dark matter. But the missing baryons is a mystery that will be new to a lot of people. It turns out that, you know, baryons are just a name for the kind of particles that make up ordinary atoms, mostly protons and neutrons. That's where they get most of their mass. And it turns out that if you look way back in time, which you do by looking way out in space, because light has a finite speed and takes a while to cross space, you see a lot more baryons around early in the universe's history than you do now. In fact, about twice as many way back 13 billion years ago or so than you see nowadays. There's no way to get rid of them. We have conservation of matter, you know. So the baryons can't have gone away. They must be hiding somewhere now.
So where do scientists think that they're hiding?
Well, that's the mystery, isn't it?
Yeah. You know?
About 10% of them are in ordinary galaxies. That's about 10%. Another 40% or so is in gas that's inside galaxies. They managed to track them down. The other 50%, no one's sure. That's why it's a mystery. But they think that they might be in this amazingly tenuous charged gas called a plasma that's out in intergalactic space.
Why do you say tenuous?
Well, very thinly spread, hard to detect. This stuff that's spread out all over the universe, but so thin that you can't really see it. But if you add up a little bit of density over a huge volume of space, then you wind up with a lot of matter. So it's possible that when astronomers actually learn to detect these things, they will manage to find out that this stuff is out there and that that's where all the baryons are.
For our last mystery, let's talk about the elephant in the room, dark energy. What do we know about it and what can we find out?
What we know basically is that it's there. But what it is, we haven't a clue. In some ways, I really didn't want to tackle this mystery because it is such a mystery. Astronomers discovered it in the late 1990s by measuring type 1A supernovas. Nice thing about type 1A supernovas is that astronomers think that they all explode in the same way and the same brightness. So that means that you know how bright it is. That makes it easy to determine how far away it is. And by looking at these things at different distances and studying their light, you can tell how fast the universe has been expanding at different times during its history. And it turns out that at least in the most recent few billion years of the universe's history, it's been speeding up. Now, that isn't what astronomers were expecting to find out. They thought that the universe started off blowing apart in the Big Bang, and then it would slow down under the effect of its gravity. It would sort of coast to a halt, perhaps, or maybe go on forever, but slower and slower, you know. Instead, it turns out that it's speeding up, and there's just no way that it could be happening unless there's some mysterious energy that's blowing it apart and making it move faster and faster. So what that is, well, there are three possibilities. One possibility is that it is some property of space itself. Another possibility is that it is something that's in space, some sort of force field that's doing the trick. And the third possibility is that scientists are completely off base and it's something they just haven't thought of yet.
So how are they going to distinguish between these options?
They do this by measuring something called the equation of state of the dark energy, by measuring a property of it, just to see more and more what it's like. And there's this factor called W, which astronomers are trying to measure. And if it's exactly equal to minus one, then it turns out that it's a property of space itself, a cosmological constant, and the constant is minus one. If it's almost but not quite minus one, then it turns out that it's a force field in space called a quintessence. The problem is you're never going to be able to measure something exactly. There's always going to be some error. The nightmare scenario that this raises, the specter that keeps these people awake at night, is that we may never know what dark energy is. You know, this may be one of those mysteries that never gets solved. And that's embarrassing because it's most of the universe, and it's what's determining the fate of the universe. You know, you never like to say that scientists have bit off more than they can chew, but it may well be that in this case, even the experts aren't sure that they'll ever have an answer to this particular mystery.
Wow.
And it's the whopper of a mystery.
Well, Robert, thanks for the mystery tour. Everyone should check out the other mysteries that are we're leaving them in the dark about.
We've got some good ones.
Robert Kuntz is a deputy news editor for Science. You can read more about the mysteries of astronomy, including dark matter, the source of the highest energy cosmic rays, and more at www.sciencemag.org/special/astro2012 or follow the hashtag Astro2012 on Twitter.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. So, Dave, our first story here is about some of the earliest social inequality.
Right, Carrie. Those of us, especially in the United States, may be familiar with the recent Occupy Wall Street movement, which has sort of pitted the so-called 99 percenters against the 1 percenters, the point being that there is this deep divide in modern society between the people that have a lot and the people that don't have a lot. And the question this new study is really asking is, when did that start? When did social stratification really begin in human society? Most scientists agree that social stratification happened when people stopped their hunting-gathering lifestyles, where you really couldn't own that much property because everything you had, you're really taking along with you. And when we really settled down, set up farms, and therefore, this is really the first time we actually sort of own property, maybe even considered ourselves maybe even owning the land. And then you would start to think, well, maybe people that had more land or better land all of a sudden are differentiating themselves from the people that had less land or perhaps less fertile land. But the exact time point when this happened has really sort of been unclear.
And so how can we judge social equality and inequality back so far in time before we may have had kingdoms and tombs full of gold?
Well, it's a great question. And one of the things that researchers have used are things like, you know, what kind of objects were people buried with? You know, were they buried with fancy pottery and stone tools? That might be an indication that somebody had a higher status than somebody else. And researchers have seen that, but they haven't seen it sort of consistently enough where they've really able to say, well, in this particular society, this is where social stratification started, or in this particular time point. What's made it easier in this new study is a technique called isotopic analysis, where the researchers actually looked at a society that was suspected of being socially stratified, but researchers didn't really know for sure. This is a society that's referred to as the LBK. And this is a group of farmers that lived in what is today Hungary about 7,500 years ago, and they lasted for about 500 years before they were replaced by other peoples. And what the researchers did was they looked at the ratio of two isotopes of the element strontium in the teeth of these people. And the reason they looked at strontium is because strontium can vary depending on what your diet is. People that tend to live in places that had very rich and fertile soil tend to have different levels of strontium in their teeth than people that lived in places that had less fertile soil. And this is something you can track over the generations. And what the researchers found was that men in this LBK society that tended to be buried with what are called adzes, which are these stone tools, so a potential indicator of high status, also tended to have a ratio of strontium in their teeth, which indicated that they lived on very fertile soil. And they tend to be buried alongside other men that had a similar ratio. And again, the researchers sort of saw this down through the generations. And what this suggests is that you had in this society a group of people that were living on sort of very nice farmland and another group of people that had different strontium ratios that weren't living on as nice of land and weren't eating perhaps as high quality of food. And this suggests more strongly than other evidence that social stratification was in place around 7,000 years ago, at least in this population of people.
Wow. All right. Well, continuing in the 21st century, we have a story about a silent killer.
Right. What some doctors call the silent killer is actually low-level inflammation. And this is particularly a problem in people in Western societies. They have this sort of chronic low-level inflammation. A lot of it's caused by stress or obesity, sometimes diseases like herpes, other diseases that sort of stick around in the body, don't really go away, really continually stimulate the immune system, which actually isn't a good thing. And it's called the silent killer because it's kind of hard to pick up, and it can cause everything from heart attacks to strokes to diabetes to cancer. So it's not a good thing. What this new study is about is trying to figure out, does that same thing happen in less industrialized societies? And specifically in this study, researchers looked at the Shuar people who live in the Amazon of Ecuador. So this is a very low-tech society. In fact, they're really exposed to a lot of bad things growing up, parasites, viruses, other pathogens. The bad part about that is a lot of the children in the society die before the age of 5 years old. But there's a potential silver lining with this new study is bringing up is that somehow from being exposed to these pathogens really early on seems to protect them from this low-level inflammation that we in the West have a real problem with.
So those that do survive beyond the age of five actually have healthier immune systems?
Exactly.
So how How did they carry out the study? How does one quantitatively measure chronic inflammation?
Well, what the researchers did is they looked at something called C-reactive protein, which is a marker in all of our blood that sort of gauges your inflammatory response. So if you've got a lot of C-reactive protein, chances are you've got inflammation going on in the body. And if you've got a lot of this protein over time, it means you really have this chronic inflammation. And what the researchers did was they took a lot of blood samples from the Shuar people in the Amazon, and they found that even though they occasionally had spikes in C-reactive protein, which could just be the result of them fighting an infection, they didn't have high levels of it over time, like we see in the West, which means the adults in the society don't really have this chronic inflammatory response that we see in a lot of Western cultures.
So this all basically comes back to the hygiene hypothesis, which is a hot topic right now, and we actually had an interview about it on the podcast a few months ago.
Right, exactly. We've talked about this before. This is the idea that quote-unquote unhealthy living conditions early on in life, exposure to disease, even allergens, can actually potentially be a benefit later in life by protecting us from disease, from things like stroke and heart attack, and even from allergies. And this study really adds more weight to that hypothesis.
All right. Well, someday if I do eventually have kids, I will let them play in the mud.
Right.
And now in our third story today, we have a totally bizarre story about a very particular scent.
Right. This is what's maybe not so kindly referred to as old person smell. And anybody who's walked into maybe their grandparents' house or a nursing home knows what I'm talking about. This is sort of an odor that people tend to associate with old people. The Japanese actually even have a name for it, which I'm not going to even try to pronounce. But if you want to look at it, you can check it out on the website. But the purpose of this new study was really to figure out, is there really a smell associated with old people? And is this different from the smell that younger people give off?
So I sense a sniffing test
right.
coming into play here.
That's exactly what they did. What the researchers did was they rounded up a group of people of a variety of ages, young people, middle-aged people, and older people. And by older people, they were talking about people that were 75 to 95 years old. They made them wear T-shirts for a few nights in a row that had these pads sewn into the armpits. And then they took these pads to another group of volunteers, and they had these volunteers sniff the pads and do a couple things. First of all, they had the volunteers guess at how old is the person do you think that this pad belongs to? And second of all, how would you rate this smell? Is this a bad smell? Is it a good smell? What does it smell like? And the volunteers were pretty good at judging what pads came from which people. They were pretty good, about 12% greater than chance in guessing the old people, and even better, about 85% better than chance in guessing that some of the other pads came from younger donors. What was actually even more surprising than that is that the volunteers rated the old person smell as the least unpleasant of the three ages that they'd sniffed.
So why would a person's scent change over the course of their lifetime?
Well, the researchers say they may have some sort of evolutionary advantage, or at least that's the reason we may have been able to evolve to distinguish these cells. The idea being, especially a long time ago, people that lived older were more desirable mates. Maybe they were more resistant to disease, somehow healthier, and this made them more desirable mates, and therefore you'd want to be able to tell just by smell, perhaps, whether someone is somebody you want to, for lack of a better word, get with than somebody else. So that's one possible explanation, although researchers really don't know for sure.
Oh, interesting. And so what else have we had on the news site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about a group of adults playing hide and seek and what the military applications of that are. Also a story about the age of the Milky Way and getting some more precise dates on it and more sense of actually how it formed. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a controversial new site for marine research. Also a story about what U.S. presidential candidate Mitt Romney thinks about science and what decisions he might make regarding the future of scientific research if he's elected president. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about geoengineering, the plans to sort of manually tinker with the environment to perhaps forestall the effects of climate change. And next week, Science Live is about the microbiome. This is the community of bugs that live in our intestines, how our diet influences their composition, and how their composition influences our health. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the June 1st, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.